Hardin. We're very fortunate to have a man of this intelligence and experience to come to our parish, and I appreciate his time very much. Father Hardin has written 11 books and over 100 articles in different religious publications. He's given very many conferences to nuns and priests throughout the country and lectured at many state and private universities. His field is theology and comparative religion, and I will not try to extend an introduction beyond reasonable lengths, and I won't make any lame jokes or anything like that, but I do wish to tell Father Hardin in your name how welcome he is and how delighted we are that he would spend the time to come here and give us these series of lectures. Father Hardin.
I think the understanding is that after my speaking for maybe 45 or so minutes, we'll have time for some questions, comments, or objections from the floor. Either if you wish to verbalize them, or if you want to, preferably, as you please, to write them out on some card or slip of paper, and I will do what I can. I think I should begin by thanking you for the privilege of speaking to you this evening. Your coming here is a tribute to your concern about Catholic education in today's revolutionary world. It is also a tribute to your faith, which we instinctively recognize needs to be understood more clearly and more deeply than ever before, at the risk of seeing this faith weakened or even deadened by conflict with a secularist culture in modern society. But I think best of all, your coming here is a witness to your desire to grow in faith, in your own faith, and to help others who depend on you to grow in theirs, in that faith which God has given us for only one purpose: to draw closer to him in the present life and reach him in the eternal position of his beauty in the life to come. In approaching our topic for tonight, a rather forbidding topic, you don't use imperatives these days. What must Catholics believe today? I thought I might anticipate by suggesting three areas that we can mutually cover. First, to ask ourselves and try to answer, why raise this question at all? Secondly, what are the fundamental articles of the Catholic faith most challenged today? And thirdly, what are some practical implications for every believing Catholic, now and into the foreseeable future? First, then, why raise the question? If we ask why this question should be raised at all, that is, what must Catholics believe, a variety of plausible answers can be given. We might say reasonably that Catholics are living in a very sophisticated society that keeps demanding of them to give an account of their faith. Or again, there are so many questions raised nowadays about so many issues touching on the faith. It seems critically important to be able to sift these out and find out what are the options in Catholicism and what are the imperatives. These and similar answers are true enough, but I don't think they touch on the heart of the problem. In fact, the reason why I chose of all possible subjects this one for the opening topic of these conferences. In my judgment, the most crucial reason why we raise the question is that a growing number of writers and speakers, very knowledgeable, still nominally and professedly Catholic, no longer profess the historic faith of Roman Catholicism. Their writings and statements across the whole spectrum of religious belief and moral practice place the average Catholic, and not only the lay person, but as I well know, teaching priests, and working with bishops, members of the hierarchy, place all Catholics in a difficult position. What's the problem are men like Hans Küng and Gregory Baum, Leslie Deward and Michael Novak Catholics? They claim to be, but then the dilemma: if they are expressing authentic Catholic belief in open contradiction at many points to the historic faith of the Catholic Church, there seems no escaping one of two obvious conclusions. Either they are wrong, or the Church has been wrong. No wonder that we ask, what must Catholics believe to be, and not merely claim to be, truly Catholic? As recently as 10 years ago, I seriously thought that I would actually be talking on this subject to a Catholic audience. Unless some intelligible answer is given to this question, who is right and who is wrong, we have confusion twice confounded, as I painfully know we have just lost at the theologate that I teach our fifth faculty member to the priesthood. Why do I say that unless we give a reasonable answer to this question, we have confusion twice confounded? Once because doubts are raised on intellectual grounds about the cardinal mysteries of Catholic Christianity, and once again because persons who are purportedly interpreting these mysteries contradict the Church's perennial teaching. We get some idea of the influence of ideas at variance with Catholic thought when we read the valedictory of Bishop Shannon, formerly auxiliary of St. Paul and Minneapolis, with whom I had lunch 6 weeks before he left the episcopate. Just before he left, he wrote a studied position paper on the Church, carefully written, heavily footnoted. He must have spent many hours studying what he would write. Having written this paper on the Church, he then logically proceeded to leave the Church. His analysis was based on the writings of one man, that of the German theologian Hans Küng, who only this month spoke, among other places, in Chicago and at the major seminary of the Archdiocese of Detroit. I might add on a personal note that about 6 weeks ago I was called up by NBC whether I would be interested in dialoguing with Hans Küng on the Cup Show in Chicago. I said I would be delighted. After 3 weeks of vain effort by telephone to find him somewhere in Europe, they found him. They offered him the invitation. He turned it down, as he had previously done in New York City and in Milwaukee. So why raise the question? For the simple reason that Catholics are faced with a difficult option of deciding whether those who speak learnedly and persuasively about the Catholic religion are expressing the faith of the Catholic Church. As we approach the second dimension of our subject, the fundamental mysteries that are being challenged, we might begin by saying there are two ways of dealing with this second of our three questions. Namely, what are the fundamental mysteries of the Catholic faith that are being challenged and called into doubt. The first way would be to restate and then analyze the Credo of the People of God, issued by Pope Paul VI on June the 29th, 1968, when he closed the Year of Faith, commemorating the 19th centenary of the martyrdom of the Holy Apostles, Peter and Paul. On that occasion, he made a solemn profession of faith, running through 10 pages, in which he said he was declaring what every faithful Catholic must believe if he wishes to remain in full communion with the Church. The Pope introduced the profession with an incisive paragraph that aptly describes why we need such a profession today. It also explains why a program like tonight's is so important for the future vitality of Catholicism in the modern world. I quote the Sovereign Pontiff. In making this profession, we are aware of the disquiet which agitates certain modern quarters with regard to the faith. They do not escape the influence of a world being profoundly changed, in which so many certainties are being disputed or discussed. We see even Catholics allowing themselves to be seized by a kind of passion for novelty and change. The Church most assuredly has always the duty to carry on the effort to study more deeply and to present in a manner ever better adapted to successive generations the unfathomable mysteries of God, rich for all in fruits of salvation. But at the same time, the greatest care must be taken, while fulfilling the indispensable duty of research, to do no injury to the teachings of Christian doctrine, for that would be to give rise, as is unfortunately seen in these days, to disturbance and perplexity in many faithful souls. One more statement from Pope Paul. I commend, by the way, that document to all of you. Before he began his profession of faith, which is the faith of all of us, he declared, to the glory of God, trusting in the aid of the Blessed Virgin Mary and of the Holy Apostles Peter and Paul, for the profit and building up of the Church, in the name of all the pastors and all the faithful, we pronounce this profession of faith. Unquote, the Pope. This profession is clear and plain. It is sufficiently detailed and expressed in present-day language for everyone to understand. It should be in the hands of every believing Catholic, who treasures the heritage of his God-given belief. I might add, it is available in stock quantity from the United States Catholic Conference in Washington, D.C. That would be one way of answering our question as to which fundamental truths of Christianity must still be professed today, as always, by everyone who professes to be a Catholic. And I might add, who has access to God's grace, which is given only to those who believe. Another approach to the same question is to read through the current literature. Remember our question? What are the fundamental mysteries of the faith that are being challenged in our day? Read through the books and articles, monographs and conferences, which are becoming literally mountainous, and select those areas of the faith that are most constantly and most penetratingly now under fire. Having chosen these, we are then in a position to see what consequences follow if and when these mysteries are exposed to uncertainty. I make no pretense of having read all this literature, or even most of the extant writing critical of Catholic Christianity. It is simply too immense. But I have read a good deal. Perhaps in and from 1,000 volumes and articles in the production of my latest book, Christianity in the 20th Century, due for publication on the 19th of this month. I might add, listen, a secular publisher wrote to me 3 years ago, Doubleday is not a Catholic publishing house. They wrote and they asked, could you tell us what's happening in the Catholic Church today? So I wrote back and I said, do you really want to know? Yes, we want to know. So then I asked, how much space do you give me? Well, they said, we think 150,000 words. I signed a contract for 150,000 words. The volume turned out to be 260,000 words. And about half of the original manuscript had to be cut. All I want to share with you, with such humility as I can muster, that I think I know what I am saying when I tell you that the Catholic Church today is going through the most serious revolution of its history graver than that of the 16th century, and it makes all the difference for the future who will remain Catholic. And I don't mean just among the laity. It will be only those who in today's world have taken stock of the fundamentals of their belief, understood them, and understood why they believe them. Out of this forest of printed matter, I think three mysteries of the faith are mainly being attacked, and the verb is not too strong. They can be expressed in three words: God, Christ, and the Church. Suppose we look at each of these for just a few minutes. You see, we could start not four conferences on four evenings, but literally 4 years of a course in theology, and would then only begin. Hence the importance of at least synthesizing those essentials, and please God, doing the studying that we must all do now if we want to keep this faith we still possess. First, regarding God. Since the dawn of historic Judeo-Christian revelation, God has been affirmed to be the Almighty Creator of heaven and earth, all perfect and all holy, all-knowing and all-good, infinite in being and immutable in essence, who made the world and governs it by his loving providence, but who himself remains utterly unchanged. In a word, he is God. What are some latter-day self-appointed spokesmen for Catholic theology saying? Like the featured speaker this past September at the National Assembly of the Conference of Major Superiors of Religious Women in the United States. Though still using the name God as a pious appellative, they opt, and they mean it, they opt for a finite God, one, in other words, who is not infinite in being, who is not all perfect in essence, who is not absolutely transcendent. They prefer to speak of a God who is still in the process of becoming, and who is literally evolving into perfection as part of the cosmic evolution of the universe. And then, for good measure, they add, it is mankind that is contributing to this becoming of God. regarding the person of Christ, the undivided Christian faith in the person of Jesus of Nazareth has affirmed him to be simply God in human form, one in being with the Father, who, as we profess, for us men and for our salvation came down from heaven, was conceived of the Virgin Mary, was born, died, and rose again by his own power from the dead. But how is Christ being portrayed by some who profess to be still teaching the faith of Christendom? His divinity is relegated to a footnote, while his undoubted human nature is presented in such terms as to make it metaphysically impossible to affirm its consubstantial union with the Godhead. He is made out to be a sinner like us, subject to the same passions. His miracles, including his resurrection, are reduced to subjective marvels. Just last night, I read a book, nominally by a Catholic, read, I know, by thousands of, especially, and you will begin to see what's happening in Catholic schools, by thousands of religious women, who distinguishes between miracles and marvels. Miracles, he says, would be in the objective order if they took place. What the Gospels describe, he says, are only subjective marvels. And as a consequence, removing the keystone of a historic rationale for any of Christ's exalted claims. Why believe in a man, no matter how wise or shrewd, who is preaching an impossible ideal and then naively supposes that people will try to live up to that ideal? Thus the solemn definitions about the person of Christ, for which thousands of martyrs shed their blood, proclaimed by the councils of Nicaea and Chalcedon, Ephesus and Constantinople, are, as one prominent American theologian states, I quote, merely verbal propositions that come and go, that may therefore be accepted or denied without injury to the Christian philosophy of life. I regret to say that theologian carries an S.J. after his name. The third area of fundamental mysteries that are being challenged today is the church. As Catholic Christianity understands itself, Christ founded his church on the apostles, whom he specially consecrated and gave them power to transmit the same office to their successors. The power of teaching his message of salvation indefectibly until the end of time. The authority of guiding and ruling the faithful in their moral lives, so that when they are told that something is sinful, they are sure it is. And the power of sanctifying the people of God through the Mass and the sacraments, all of that is locked up in the mystery of the Church. The Church further understands that Christ chose Peter and his successors in the papacy as visible head of the mystical body on earth, with divinely invested rights, possessing the keys of the kingdom of heaven, so that whatsoever they bind on earth would be bound in heaven. Listen. Whatsoever an old man who speaks broken English on the shores of the Tiber binds on earth is ratified in heaven. That's the Catholic faith. Far otherwise, however, is the ecclesiology of men, created in large measure by the media. I know not a few of them will, personally, and my job as teacher of theology has been, for better or worse, to rate intelligence. I would rate not a few of them a very mediocre mind. But blown into notoriety by the media, who deny the apostolic succession. What power do the bishops have? None. Hans Kung says none, no more than any baptized Christian. Who deny the sacramental powers of the episcopate and the priesthood. Is it any wonder we struggle with the young men being ordained, who are wondering what is a priest, or 2 weeks before sacramental orders, spend half the night struggling with their identity? Ecclesiologists who deny the papal primacy in its correlative papal infallibility, who deny that Christ ever founded a society of which he is the invisible guide who protects his church from error in faith and morals, and so surely protects that church that a Catholic should be willing to lay down his life rather than deny that faith. All of this and more can be read by anyone familiar with the accumulating literature published under nominally Catholic auspices, and, sad to say, not infrequently bearing the imprimatur of some member of the hierarchy. So much for our second dimension. Now some practical implications. All that we have said so far is common knowledge to anyone familiar with a theological scene. What is less obvious is the practical implications which this raises for believing Catholics, all of us, clergy, religious, and laity. And I should add, for those present here tonight, and for those who figured it wasn't worth it. Let me suggest one implication each for the triad of Christian mysteries so deeply challenged today, namely God, Christ, and the Church. A person who believes that God is all that Revelation says about him, the Almighty Creator who governs the universe by his providence, a person who believes in that kind of a God, prays. Do you begin to see one reason why there's a crisis of faith in the Church today? These are not theological formulas. These are truths. If I believe them, I live by them. Prayer, then, is the primary consequence of this first cardinal mystery of Christianity. And among the prayers we should earnestly address to God daily is to have mercy on his people and enlighten Christian leaders, especially, and I speak this from the depth of my heart, especially bishops and priests. I work with both. Pray that God might enlighten them, or shall I say us, to have the courage, please God, the courage to lead the faithful according to the truth. A person who believes that Christ is all that the Scriptures say about him, that Mary gave birth to her Creator at Bethlehem, that he is therefore God in human form, who became man not only to redeem us, but also and very much to teach us by his example of how we are to live. A person who believes this will strive to imitate. He will honestly try to become more like Christ in his conduct. And he will read that New Testament not as a piece of pious platitude, but as speaking to him and bidding him do likewise in kindness and patience, in humility and love, in chastity and self-control. Finally, a person who believes in the Church founded by Christ will take the founder seriously. when he told the apostles and their successors, "He that hears you hears me." In a word, a Catholic will obey. He recognizes in a way that those who don't have his faith cannot see. He will recognize in those whom Christ has placed as leaders in the church, sinful human beings like himself. Maybe, and too often it happens, maybe intellectually he is inferior. Yet, if he believes, but what a hypothesis, if he believes, he will see in these men Christ's own representatives, especially in his vicar, the Bishop of Rome, a man who literally speaks in the name of God. And while he knows the price this often demands, you don't obey the teachings of the church today without paying for it. I with my celibacy, you with your loyalty to the demands of marriage. We also know, if we obey, that Christ, who gave the perfect lesson of obedience, died on the cross to teach us how to obey. I still have a short epilogue. Remember the topic we are talking about, just to remind ourselves? What must Catholics believe today? I would like to make just one pointed observation on the verb believe. After everything has been said and done, we might ask ourselves, why all the bother? Why this preoccupation with articles of belief? So there's a God. So there are three persons in God. So there are two natures in Christ. So what? What difference, really, what difference does it make what we believe? Is not the important thing what we do? Yes, provided we keep in mind that the important thing Christ expects his followers to do is to believe. Viewed in this life, that our primary duty as Christians is not all the myriad ramifications of the moral law. Our primary duty is to believe. Faith then is seen to be something more than merely verbalizing religious formulas. It is not only putting into words what, presumably, God has revealed. Faith is that fundamental adoration of the human spirit before the mind of God, by which we humbly submit our mind That's the hardest sacrifice we have to make. To accept on God's word what we cannot understand. You see, that's what faith is all about. Believing what we cannot understand, and thereby worshiping the God who made us. In the years to come, once the present storm is over, we shall see, and I hope we all soon see the day, better than we do now, how much belongs to those who believe. Everything that God has revealed, just because he revealed it, and not because we comprehend what we believe, if we do that, we are promised the greatest blessing that the human heart can experience this side of heaven. Deep down, internal peace. Peace with ourselves. Peace with others. Peace with the world. Born of the conviction that in believing we are in contact with the truth, whose name we know is God. Once we are sure we have God, nothing in this valley of tears is too difficult to suffer. That peace is promised only to those who believe. Thank you for patiently listening.
We will have a short break. The ladies have been preparing coffee. Perhaps you heard the coffee pots going during the lecture. Help yourselves, and the rest of the session will be an informal question and answer period. So any of you may ask a question from the floor, and Father Hardin will repeat it and give his answer. So rally around the coffee pot and come back, and we'll...
I would like to know whether, if you have the questions now, or do we break up now and then come back? What do
we
do?
Break up and come back. They'll just get some coffee.
See, 5 minutes, or shall we talk?
Yes, Father suggests we take about 5 minutes or so. And in the meantime, if I may be spared one short commercial, we just happen to have a few copies of Father's book here, and it is be a wonderful investment for you, not only for your own reading, but for a reference book for yourselves and for your children. So feel free to examine it during this period. Thank you.
Normally, if I may have your attention. Please. It was suggested that I ask those who are standing to please come and sit down. Normally, for a discussion period afterwards, I found it helpful if there are notations written on a paper. It might say prime the pump. Sometimes it's a little slow getting if we ask for the questions from the floor. But suppose we do start with whomever we have. Yes? Yes, sir.
There was a couple of points that I wasn't exactly clear what you were saying, but the thing, I'll just ask one. You made the statement that God
The question is, I said that God gives grace to those who believe. In fact, only did I say only to those who believe. And the question then was, well, if that is true, or what is the context in which I was speaking? Because obviously, not all are Catholics, and indeed, not all people are Christian. I might add that my professional work is teaching comparative religion. And I do teach, for example, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam, and am very sympathetic with an understanding of those who are not Christian. What I meant was, and the context was, those who have been given the opportunity to believe in Christ, and indeed who had believed in Christ, and who no longer believe. It is, I think, quite obvious that whatever grace God gives them, it could be only the grace of converting them to believe, because attached to belief in Christ is an ocean of grace which is reserved quite uniquely to those who have received that first grace of believing. Now, evidently, those who are not Catholic but are Christian, and indeed even those who are not Christian, are still given enough grace for salvation. That's assumed. In other words, the possibility of salvation is open to everyone. This is part of our faith. What I wanted to stress and emphasize was the fact that for us as Christians, the grace that God intends to give those who believe is conditioned on that faith. And that in the degree to which I either weaken in my faith commitment, or worse still, reject it, well, quite frankly, I make it, humanly speaking, impossible for God to give me the graces which he has by his own divine intention attached to faith. That's what I meant. Yes. How would I deal with? Well, as a matter of fact, though I don't have, say, the episcopal authority that his bishop has, I do have considerable authority. In fact, I'm exercising it this evening. So it's not a hypothesis. What I would do about Hans Küng, I am doing it. I would add, however, and this is probably behind your question, that if, say, I were, which happily I am not, a bishop, what should be done, maybe that's the question, with a man like Hans Küng, who obviously and overtly denies a whole gamut of fundamental Catholic doctrine? Well, I would say that in today's world, and I think I speak for people who are in a position to take action and are not taking it, in today's world, the great hope which the Church has, and that if I were Küng's bishop, I would have, is that provided there are people who will answer King on his own grounds and show from the principles or the premises on which he is arguing that he is no longer speaking as a Catholic, that he would gradually, as he is becoming, isolated from the followers that he still has among Roman Catholics. In other words, the Church has, I think, wisely decided that with men like Hans Küng, you must trust to the faith of the people and their intelligence to recognize that what he is saying is not historic Catholicism. For those who are frankly sympathetic with his teaching or lack the intelligence to distinguish what he is teaching from what the Church believes is true, with those people it's just a matter of time when they, like him, will cease to be Catholics, because no one has to excommunicate Hans Küng. He has long ago excommunicated himself. Yes. The question is a very incisive one. The lady asked, why is it that, for example, in high school teaching, though I think it could apply to other areas of Catholic teaching too, why, if there is, and there is a great deal of theological freewheeling, why isn't there, or is there, someone in the diocese? I'm repeating your question. To say, this is it, and that isn't it. This is Catholic doctrine, that is not. Teach this, don't teach that. Is that your question? Yes, there is such authority in the Archdiocese of Chicago, and it does reside with His Eminence and those who have episcopal authority in the Archdiocese. I think I know Cardinal Cody well enough to say that he wants to exercise that kind of authority. I might add, however, that the problem is more complex than seems. And the problem, frankly, is the choice between the lesser of two evils, hoping, and here I am reconstructing, I don't know whether Cardinal Cody, if he were standing here, would say just this, but I can understand, dealing with other bishops on this very subject, in fact I just wrote to one last night on this very subject, except that in his case, it was a matter of his college in his diocese. That is not only in left field, but out of the ballpark when it comes to Catholic teaching. My suggestion to His Excellency, and you will understand at least how I think a bishop might handle the problem, was that first to tell him there are men, in this case priests, in the college, and there is fairly large faculty, where I would suspect have really lost the fullness of the Catholic faith. And consequently, that his first responsibility, there's no chance, I trust, in a million you're guessing who the bishop is, that I told him I thought his first responsibility is to find out who are such priests and then to use the authority that in him lies to release those people from teaching positions on that faculty. There are many others, and I presume most of them, who are simply confused. And the confusion often is in very good minds. In fact, I suppose there is a correlation between a perspicacious intellect and a difficulty of accepting the fullness of the Catholic faith. And consequently, that these people should be helped through a program of retooling, re-education, seminars, programs to help them rediscover, if need be, what a Catholic today, as say a teacher in a college, Catholic college, should believe and therefore teach. But here's the fear, and I speak without guessing, the fear, both as regarding, for example, priests and religious women, all lay teachers, those who are in, say, the field of education, on the part of authorities, and that was the question that the man there raised regarding Hans Küng. It's basically the same question. What should I, say, as a bishop, do right now? Suppose I say, either you teach this tomorrow or else. You know what would happen. Or else. Or else. In other words, the number of people who are not that sure of their own position today, theologically, because there's so much being written, so much being said, controverted in all directions, that the hope is and the prayer is that gradually these people, and if you wish, come to their theological senses, realize what a Catholic ought to believe and therefore teach, and what would otherwise be a drastic solution, which would be, frankly, the closing of schools. I'm not sure whether it's the current issue of the Sunday visitor. Somebody can enlighten me on this. But I understand someone told me that the editor of the Sunday Visitor, I think his name is Father Nevins, in either the current or recent issue of that newspaper, in reflecting on the crisis in Catholic education, says very bluntly, the heart of the crisis is not money. It is the quality of Catholic education being taught in too many schools, and that thousands of Catholic parents are now asking themselves, is it worth it? Would you agree? For example, in the Detroit Archdiocese, this year some 30 schools, Catholic schools, were closed. And one of the main reasons I know from people who work in the Archdiocese is the brand of teaching in those institutions. So that when, as you know, last fall it came to a referendum, you heard about this, the famous Michigan law that was passed, ostensibly offering state aid to the schools, where there was a rider to the bill, where those who did not vote for state aid would in effect practically disfranchise all Catholic schools, making it financially impossible to run them. The bill against the Catholic schools was passed, and I'm told by people who are politically knowledgeable in Michigan, one of the main reasons was that the vote was swung by Catholics disenchanted with a Catholic school system. So what we are talking about tonight and of the next three conferences, unless these questions are settled, I don't hesitate saying the future of Catholic education in the United States is in great jeopardy. It was the faith that built these schools. It is nothing but the Catholic faith that will keep them going. People will not support what they don't believe is worth supporting. Yes, sir. Well, in a way you're asking the wrong man, because all my professional life has been teaching in a seminary. That's what I will have tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. If you want a straightforward answer, the answer is, by and large, no. Would you repeat your question? Well, again, you're talking to the wrong man, because for reasons best known to Providence, I'm on the campus of the University of Chicago. We have a cluster of 9 divinity schools, including Chicago Divinity. My classes are in Lutheran Theological Seminary of Chicago. My students range from Jesuits to Unitarians. I must say, now you see, you just asked me. What I do, as a matter of fact, is use my own books. And consequently, I suppose I enjoy extraordinary liberty. Do you understand what I'm trying to say, though? By and large, in many, nobody knows how many, but working as I do with the American hierarchy as a consultant for the Episcopal Commission on Seminaries, I think I know what's happening in American seminaries. I can tell you very frankly that the needs on American seminaries is grave. And all that I've talked about here needs to be settled in the seminary curriculum. Otherwise, the future generation of priests will be teaching what they've learned. I remember sitting in the room of a man who teaches theology, and he answered the telephone while I was visiting him. So it was a long telephone call, and while he was at the phone, I went to his bookshelf. All I can tell you is that if he teaches what he reads, he is not teaching what you heard this evening. Yes. Well, may I insert just one word in your statement, if it gets you there?
See, the thing is that all the churches and the Catholic churches that become the Church of Christ, more guilty. See, you know, how quite a kind of sort of breaking breath being. We are the true religion. I mean, I don't think there is any such thing as a true religion. I think whatever way it gets.
Well, may I ask you, suppose I ask you a question. Now gets you there, you presumably mean to our eternal destiny. You don't mean any religious philosophy. Because, for example, I teach Islam, a semester course on Islam. Now, if there is one thing that Muhammad did not believe, is in Christ's divinity. In fact, explicitly in the Quran, more than once, he affirms that Isa, the Arabic word for Jesus, the son of Maryam, of Mary, he is not Allah, he is not God. And he condemns the Christians, the followers of Isa, as idolaters because they worship a man as though he was God. Now, in other words, all I can tell you, frankly, is that I am so sympathetic not only with Protestantism, I happen to have published 3 books on Protestantism, but the non-Christian religions, again, several titles in that field, I teach it. I see a great deal of depth and truth and beauty in Buddhism, in Islam, in Hinduism, in the various forms of Protestantism. However, having said that, it's not a matter of faith now, but of logic. I couldn't, however, say that it makes no difference whether I am a Muslim or a Christian, because at least I should choose between the two, which is better. And consequently, when I find one religion contradicting the other, and they do in many ways, then the real question that I should ask myself is not how well do I live up to what faith commitment I've got. And incidentally, my Lutheran students, I don't try to convert to Catholicism. This may sound strange, but I don't. I tell them to be good Lutherans. And in fact, I insist they study the Confession of Augsburg so they know what to preach later on. And they respect me for it, for my objectivity. But having said that a person should be faithful to such understanding of God's will as he has, as God has vouchsafed to him, yet objectively, if I look over the spectrum of religions, and this is my business, if I worked for a living, they would pay me for it, is to examine these different religions, I couldn't say they're all equally good. For example, would you pick some religion besides Catholic, just as an example, that you think doesn't make any difference? Just pick one at random. I mean, just mention one. In Buddhism. Okay. Now, as you probably know, the cardinal principle of Buddhism, as Buddha understood his faith, is that there is no transcendent being. That in the last analysis, the only being there is the ego. Well, the future of Buddhism is extinction. That's nirvana in Buddhism. Now, frankly, I love life so much that if I understand Buddhism and I compare it with Christianity, of course, I've got to understand both,
other things being equal, just on the basis of sheer logic and following my instincts, I would prefer a religion which promises me a future life, which Christianity does, in preference to a religion which, at best, offers me the cessation of suffering because my existence will be extinguished. You see, the problem regarding that I think you're raising is not a theological problem at all. It's a philosophical one. Is there truth in matters religious? And if there is, then that religion, I don't have to be Catholic to say this. I could be anything or nothing. Any religion which most approximates that truth is objectively a better religion. I may not like it because it makes too many demands on me. All right, I'm a free agent. Now, I would say, as a teacher of comparative religion, that among all the religions of history, that which is at least truest, I think it's more, is the Catholic. Why? Because it responds to most of the deepest instincts of human nature. And this I can tell my students, who in many cases are not even Christians. Yes. Well, thank you. If I may just briefly repeat what you said, namely that instinctively we tend, and this lady admitted to, and we all are urged, in fact, to follow the easier path. And consequently, it is a simple jump from that which is easier to that which, well, therefore I will do, and I will say it's true because I like it. Well, once we believe in God and believe that He has a right to make demands on us, then whatever else religion is, it's doing what He wants us to do no matter how hard it is. Now, there's no merit in just doing difficult things, but frankly, most people who have theological difficulties, I've taught theology too long not to say this, most people with theological difficulties don't have those difficulties start in the mind. It's usually in the moral order. As one Newman chaplain told me at the University of Michigan, when some bright young freshman came to him and told him, "Father, I've got doubts with the faith. I can't believe this, I can't believe that." The chaplain told me, before I even began talking to him, I would ask him to sit down, and my first question is, "How's your sex life?" And in most cases I discovered the problem was not theology. Yes. The question is, what about the young people, many of whom seem not to believe anymore? That's what you're saying. First of all, none of us really knows how much they still believe.
First of all, I think many people in our culture, as in other cultures, go through a period of what I would call skepticism or rationalism. In other words, just because a person doesn't externally practice certain things that belong to the Catholic faith doesn't mean they've actually lost the faith. In other words, I'm expressing a hope that not as many have actually lost the faith as we seem to think. Secondly, however, and this is where those of us who are not so young come in, I would commend your reading what I say about this, because I spend many pages talking about this, that the young people today may have other difficulties challenging their faith. But I think the most difficult challenge to their faith is the adults whom they see nominally or ostensibly Catholic and watching our conduct, how we express our faith. And consequently, I think whatever hope there is, and I teach all of the younger generation, men in their 20s and early 30s, whatever hope I have for their faith is the kind of faith that I have, which somehow I will communicate to them. Because whatever else we can do, we can't precisely give them the faith, for example, out of books. Or even in class, we can do just so much. The faith somehow must be communicated by believing, especially parents, believing priests, believing religious. I never dreamt I'd talk this language. The damage that has been done to the faith of the young, do you believe me? To the faith of the young, by watching priests walk out of their solemn commitments, religious women walking out, like one I heard about this summer, was negotiating a contract for a very fine salary while she was getting her master's degree in nursing education. She was going to leave the convent. See what I'm saying? So it's the faith of the rest of us that because so many adults have failed the young, this is the language I talk to priests when I give them retreats, for example, whatever hope there is for the youth is in many ways in our hands. And when I use those three words, I wasn't just being pious. When I spoke of belief in God and therefore prayer, belief in Christ and therefore following his example, belief in the church and obedience to that church, I meant it. These young are watching us with hawk's eyes. We can't kid them. They can recognize a phony before we open our mouths. But it's up to us. No. No, no, I think, in other words, that would be an unfortunate conclusion. No. I would say, though, just a moment, they were seeing a lot of other people, and as a matter of fact, the most saintly father or mother. What, for example, compare the example, even after years, of really good Catholic parents with, well, and I come back because this is my profession, the example of one priest who goes back on his commitment. So, I would say it's mainly, now this is may seem like an oversimplified statement, I really believe it is mainly through the bad example, and this is a large statement, of those who in years gone by had held up the ideals of the young, so that when the youth went wrong, we could basically just blame them. But I wouldn't say it's just yourself. In fact, I wouldn't say it is yourself. Somebody there had an observation. Yes? May I ask how recently?
Well, November 3rd, probably you should see that failed last year. And I saw the work of people, and the real reason it failed, according to the lawyers and the people in the Detroit area that I worked with, was that the law was so ambiguous in its wording, and the people were too much when they got the ballot. Now, most of the time when you want something,
I would add that my source was quite reputable. I would say this, however. Here's what I do know, as a matter of fact. I don't have to go to Michigan, though I happen to be from the Detroit province of the Society of Jesus. And I'm sure it gives us at least a kind of comfort, consolation, to think that there were other reasons than such fundamental ones as the one that I am saying. I have lectured, by the way, in the state of Michigan on Catholic education, and this is the feedback that I get. Now, I quoted, and this is all that I can say, in other words, that among the reasons given was the one that I stated. But I would not want to leave the impression that the example that I cited from Michigan is, you might say, exhibit A for the gravity of the crisis in Catholic education today. Now, may I ask you this question? Are you in Catholic education? And in your judgment, do you believe that there is a crisis regarding the teaching of Catholic doctrine in Catholic schools today? Well, that is really all that I... Well, now, may I ask, just a moment then, may I then go back to the question of the crisis? Do you believe that the crisis is, say, in more or less
along the lines that I have been speaking, or is it that they have not been, shall I say, updated enough? In other words, that what we need is more of this kind of theologizing and less of the, shall I say, well, the doctrinal, you know what I mean, the commandments and the mysteries of the faith. Where would you say is the crisis? Well, may I ask, are you teaching in this school, by the way? Well,
yeah, I'm wondering why on the Canadian scene, which I am on also, why this is not a crisis there, and everything is just about the same, and I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, now, how much time do you spend in Canada? Do you visit there occasionally? Well, I'm on the faculty of the University of Ottawa. In fact, I'm teaching there in the winter term, my fifth year. And I'd say there is a grave crisis in Canada. And the crisis is doctrinal. Well, no, it's been there for some time. I really thank you for your observations. They have been very revealing. Yes? Father suggested that we're continuing next week. I would, however, like to make an observation to that observation. It happens that the Second Vatican Council had explicitly said that religious should wear a distinctive religious habit. Once more, I thank you for your patient listening. And I hope to see you next week. Thank you.